just going to push start. So, Anna Agamon, it's so nice to see you. And we're like, I told Mr. Tolentino, I'm like super nervous because this is like for reals now.
Bye.
Thanks, mommy.
Bye.
Let me go ahead and put my phone on.
All right. So some of this is like his words and stuff, but I liked it because it really kind of captures everything anyway. And he starts with, you know, everyone who was here when you were in school, you always come back and you visit and we're so happy to see you. And we have enjoyed greatly watching you grow and blossom and take the world by storm and just move forward in such a confident and an excellent manner. And we, you know, those of us in these halls, as Mr. Tolentino put it, you know, we're aware of that, but we want to share that with the rest, with everybody else in the community who didn't necessarily get have the pleasure of working with you in person, not just in school, but, you know, afterward when you come back. So after leaving GCS in 2014, you went to UMBC, math major, right? Yeah. Minor in econ. Yeah. why did you choose math and econ as a field of study? And was it your first choice? Like, is that what you knew you wanted to do?
Yeah. So, I mean, the real tea is I actually went to College Park. So I went to College Park. I decided to major in business. And about, I would say 3 weeks in, I was like, wow, I do not like this school. And it's not because like the school was bad or anything. The food was actually excellent. The people were really nice. But I think for me, it was the career they were preparing me for was like a consultant in, you know, a bank or Wall Street. And I kind of knew that there was more that I could do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, eventually I decided to pivot into UMBC. And at UMBC, I was just like, frankly, lost. So, you know, first and foremost, I did not know what I wanted to do right out of college. You can ask, you know, former college counselors who were working with me. I would come every single day with like a new college plan. I was super stressed out. First year was stressful. Second year was stressful. And when I went to UMBC, it was, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I decided to major in biology because that's what Ghanaian immigrants, you know, their children do, right? Like, and medicine, law, and I was like, I don't really
pharmacy.
Want to do law. Pharmacy, you got it. Engineering, right? So I was like, I don't really know what I want to do. Biology, it seems like I got an A in this class. Let me just continue with it. But I really didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, it kind of should have been really obvious from then. Like, I really like my math classes. I like my politics classes, et cetera. And so it really took a while for me to get to the math and econ thing.
So when I was at your graduation party, which was a great, great party. Yeah. I met some really nice people and I sat at the table with Nikki and, you know, with Awatunde's who my heart. But also there was a woman there who was your counselor, right? There was
So is she it Dr. King?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a great segue. Dr. King was pivotal to me kind of getting to where I am today. So I always say that there's like along my academic journey, as I mentioned to you off the record, I desegregated my elementary school, which I realized in 2020, right? and I think what's really been like characterizing my journey is that I've had champions along the way. There's always been people who have really been cheering me on and really kind of embodying the full sort of nomer of allyship and sponsorship in the very real sense. And so for me, I feel like she was really critical. There was a point where I was like in a biology class and I was like, I don't care about signal transduction. I don't care about, you know, organic chemistry. None of these things are appealing to me. And I've been watching The Daily Show, TED Talks, all of these things have been like really piquing my interest from when I was here in Glen Elg. So, you know, I was in a lab at the same time I was doing malaria research at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and they put me on a data project. They said, we want you to use statistics to like analyze this data from the field. It was from Malawi. And I was like, have you guys thought about like how this is going to impact like the educational system, the healthcare system? They're like, that's not the kind of work we do here. And then I was like, wait a minute. And so as I was doing the data analysis, I was like, I really enjoy like numbers. And it's actually something that I really got from here. So Mr. Vassell was an excellent teacher. He's just been like a huge math champion in my life. And then there was Mr. Ciccolello. I took his Algebra 2 class, and that was really the class that changed everything for me. I found myself really excited about math, as well as looking forward to like learning more about how do we kind of manipulate numbers to get what we need to get, et cetera. And so it was kind of like harking back to that experience and then realizing that I need to broaden my toolkit. Majoring in biology is not going to cut it. Even though I'm 8 classes away from getting my major, I'm going to have to change. My parents were like, you're throwing your life away. No, they weren't really like that. Mom. They were just kind of like, please graduate, please graduate. I was like, I will. But I think math is really where I want to go. And the reason that we're saying please graduate is because I was very indecisive in college. I was like, maybe I want to do this, maybe I want to do that. And I actually changed my major maybe 5 times in 1 week. So like my parents,
one week.
So my parents were kind of just like, please graduate. Cause like, we don't want to like, you know, waste time or whatever. And so eventually I ended up here at math. I decided to declare math as a major, no plan in sight. And then I got a call from the university president, Dr. Freeman Hrabowski. And he said, hey, come over to my office. Want to talk to you about something. I said, okay, great. He said, I heard you change your major to math. Have you considered something called economics? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. What is that? He said, okay, go and talk to this guy called Brandon Enriquez, a good friend of mine, and ask him about what he's doing. He was double majoring in math and econ at the time. And I said, okay, no problem. Basically, long story short, he introduced me to the field of economics. He encouraged me to kind of look into it. And I realized that this was the perfect career for me. I'm interested in like data, numbers, but I'm also interested in laying it on people with politics and policy, et cetera. And it was a beautiful blend of the two. And from there, it's just kind of been history. Like I've just kind of delved in and done what I had to do.
So you just mentioned a couple of teachers here that were critical in your journey. What were some of the other teachers or classes that really influenced and maybe started? We're talking a little, again, off the record a little bit earlier about this idea of equity and social justice. Like, what were some of the things that sort of spearheaded that direction? Because you have several different directions that you've gone.
This is a really great question. So I'm trying to remember as far back as I possibly can. So, I mean, first and foremost, I think my homeroom teacher, Ms. Banker, was such an inclusive mentor, right? Mm-hmm. She really encouraged inclusive excellence. And she never made me feel like I was fundamentally different because I was a Black woman in this very white space, right? Not just a white space, right? I'm talking about, I'll tell you, the craziest thing was when I went to someone's bar mitzvah in this school and they like rented out the Raven Stadium. And that's when I knew that I was in a completely different place than like any place I'd ever been before, right? It was just insane. I was just kind of like, what? Okay. You know? And even like when friends would be like, oh, I can just like give you $100, like very casually, like for me, like that meant a lot, right? Like in terms of my own economic circumstance. So I think Ms. Banker was such a critical sort of teacher in my life. I would say the entire like math department as well. Yeah. Really, really great. They just kind of encouraged me to think deeply. Obviously I had a million questions. Like that's just kind of been my whole forte. And so I was really encouraged by them as well. But I would say like really for me, there were two classes or I would say two sort of sets of teachers that I feel like made a huge difference. So I would say my kind of like humanities teachers, right? They're no longer here. Ms. Beckford, Ms. Reed, right? Mr. Hudgens. And I would even say like Mr. Mattson, quite frankly, right? People who kind of challenged me to think deeper about issues that were affecting our world, why these things mattered, and how could you articulate your argument in a clear and concise way that people could actually like learn something from it. So I feel like Mr. Hudgens, especially when I was taking his world history class, I felt like I was forced to articulate why something mattered and then, you know, apply it to a certain context in like a conversation or in a debate. That was actually the class that we did a lot of debates in. And I think people are like, Anna, how are you so quick with it? And I'm like, listen, I've had this kind of training for a while. So I feel like for me, those were like, you know, places where I felt like I was really developing my writing, developing sort of my art of communication. Mm-hmm. And then I would say integrative was really important. Obviously, you're an integrative teacher. Yeah. Shout out to you.
A little bit. Thank you.
You know, and I think for me, integrative was really where, you know, I kind of formed, I think formed my racial identity through my research, mm-hmm. right? And so that was when I did a project. My senior integrative project was focused on racism in private schools. Mm-hmm. So initially, I actually wanted to start with this school. Obviously, people had an issue with that. So I think for me, I broadened that out and I said, okay, well, if we really want to talk about equity, let's broaden it to sort of all these independent schools that are ultimately kind of super white, super privileged, super wealthy spaces. And what it ended up becoming was more so like a focus group talking with, you know, marginalized students who are in this community about how their experiences were. Mm-hmm. And it was really validating to hear like, oh, like I've been going through the same thing you've been going through. And that was what really inspired like the Black Awareness Club. Mm-hmm. And I think at one point I even helped start something in form where we would tell people about current events, right? Yeah. Kind of keep people abreast because it's really easy to be in an environment like this and sort of ignore what's happening out there, just because like this is somewhat of a bubble, right? And that's something that we've talked about like extensively even when I was here. So mm-hmm. I think for me, those were the teachers that really kind of exposed me to things. Of course, you, of course. Yeah, you and I just would talk.
I know. So many conversations behind the circulation desk. You right. come and sit down and be like, so Ms. Zastro, this right. happened.
This happened.
I particularly remember when Christopher Mills, so Mr. Miller was here.
Yeah.
And South Africa. Oh God, my brain just stopped.
South Africa.
Yeah. He died. Oh my gosh.
Who is this?
In South Africa, Nelson Mandela.
Oh, Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela. Oh. When he died. Oh my God, I like totally had this total brain fart. But when he came and you sat down and we had this conversation about forgiveness, mm-hmm. and that forgiveness is a daily chore, right? And yeah. because Nelson Mandela, he talked about how important forgiveness was in order to move forward. And I just very distinctly remember you coming and sitting with me and the two of us just talking about mm-hmm. that subject, not just in this context, but in all contexts, right. you know, the idea of bullying and young people and, yeah. and, you know, how you see those people throughout school and you have to maintain that distance. And in order for your own mental well-being, you know, allow that forgiveness to happen.
Yeah.
So I just remember that. Okay. I'm looking down the list. Tolentino's got a list. when you look your name up, Anna Gifty Opoku Agyeman, they call you a researcher, a writer, an author, a commentator, and an activist, right? Comes back to it. Do you ever imagine that you would accomplish everything you have so far, let alone being someone that people look up to? I mean, I look up to you. All right. I think we have a mutual admiration society.
Right,
I know, right? I know. But I look at you and I'm talking to somebody, another David Rush, who graduated in 2013.
Oh, yeah.
David, he and I were having a conversation and we were talking about what is your why? Right. And I was like, you know, when I think about it, you are my why. Why do I do this? You, David, you know, watching, you are my why. And so I just, how did you expect to be that? Someone that people look up to and admire?
I can tell you there was a sort of a sign during my time here at Glenelg, my senior year. Obviously, they do like the superlatives, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
And I think it was me and Andrew Smith were most likely to become president. That was what they like the class voted, right?
Yeah.
And I think to some extent, I've always had this kind of like thread of leadership that's flowed through every aspect of my life, right? Mm-hmm. From fifth grade, I think when I was young, similar to what I did here at Glenelg, I was like, the kids got to know what's going on. Like, mm-hmm. we need to start a newspaper. And I was like, let's do it. And we kind of just did it, right? So I think to some extent, I had an inkling that this was going to be my path. I just didn't think it was going to come so soon.
Mm.
Right. So I thought like, oh, okay. Like when I'm 40, like all these things will happen. And it's like, okay, like I'll build up to that. But I think what I realized was that, you know, you don't have to wait to like change circumstances around you. Right. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes if you do wait, things get worse.
Right.
So I think for me, it was sort of the urgency around we need equity now. Like, yeah. it doesn't make sense for people to be living in subpar conditions as compared to other people just because of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for me, my why is kind of specific. I'm very into centering Black people whenever, however, anywhere, everywhere, because I think that Black people have been the most marginalized group quite frankly, across the world. I see it in, you know, my own experience as a Ghanaian American. I see it as somebody who identifies alongside the African American community, right? Because those were the first Black people I really got to engage with when I came to America. So it's sort of like this plight of Black folks that I kind of use as my why to really propel everything forward. And my argument is really simple, right? And this is an argument I get from a chief economist that I know called Janelle Jones. She's actually in charge of the DOL right now, the Department of Labor. Is, you know, if we improve conditions for Black folks, everybody benefits because Black people are worse off than everybody else.
Just the economic boost from
quite literally
lifting them up lifts everybody, and that to me is the part that I just don't get.
Yeah, so I think I can say even more broadly, Black and Brown folks. So I feel like Latinx folks also kind of get pushed out, but it's like I think making sure that we're centering the most marginalized, that's kind of the biggest thing here, to ensure that they have the best outcome means that that's a better outcome for everybody else, right? Yeah. So I think that's my why. That's like my biggest why. So in terms of your question, I expected it, but I didn't expect it so soon.
So soon, yeah. So and here, so again, back to the notes in 2018, prior to moving on to study at Harvard University, the sweatshirt repping here, you co-founded the Sadie Collective. Right, to address that pipeline for Black women in economics, finance, data science, policy, and it's global at this point. What spurred you into what we just talked about? Is that what spurred you to create the Sadie Collective, or what was sort of the trigger?
Yeah, it was pretty practical, right? So when I was exposed to economics, I was like, this is really cool. I'd actually realized that over the years, I've been watching economists on TED Talks, but I had no idea what an economist was. I thought they were like a lawyer or something, so I'm like, I don't know what that is. So coming back to that, I was like, okay, I need to find some like Black women economists to identify with. Couldn't find any. And I was like, they're out there. I know they're out there because I know at least one, right? Dr. Lisa D. Cook, who's my mentor. So I was like, I prayed about it, I meditated on it, and the idea of like there needs to be a conference for Black women all in one place really came out of, you know, I was with my co-founder, we were at a conference, and there was a Black woman economist, another Black woman economist, she said, the number of Black women coming into economics is declining, and there's not a lot of Black women to begin with. If we're not careful, there's going to be no Black women whatsoever in these spaces, and that's going to be a detriment to, you know, Black women, of course, but then their communities, because Black women oftentimes are the economic backbone of their communities.
Yeah.
So, the idea came then, but then, you know, I prayed about it, and it was like, hold. A couple months later, I ended up doing an internship at the University of Chicago. As you know, Chicago is a pretty diverse city.
Mm-hmm.
UChicago is not. It is not a diverse school. It's pretty white. And I was like, I'm really confused. I've only seen like 40 shades of beige on this campus. But we in Chicago. And when I walked outside of the campus, it was like, And so this was my experience. On one hand, my co-founder was at the Federal Reserve in DC, and she had just started her new job. And she was also going through a very similar experience where she was the only Black woman in her entire division.
Yeah.
As a research assistant, right? Not even, like, including staff, et
cetera. Well, and talk about intersectionality at that point.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So we're kind of talking about this diversity thing, and I said, I have an idea. What if we created a conference for Black women? Like, what would that do? And she was like, let's do it. Within 4 months, we got a team of about 7 Black women, and we put on the very first conference for Black women in economics and related fields. And I don't think anybody thought we were going to be successful. I think some people were like, ooh, we'll give you guys some money. Like, this is cute. Right? But, like, you know me. Like, I'm like, I'm not doing this, like, a one time. Like, we're trying to change things here, right? Like, why are the Black women missing in this space? And it turns out they weren't missing. They were really hidden, right? Like, no one really knew where they were. And so the first conference happens, and it was hosted by Mathematica Policy Research, which is now Mathematica Now in D.C., and they gave us that space for free. Like, a lot of people don't know, right? Yeah. Like, we were entirely crowdfunded our first year. And then we got into Forbes. And then we got into NPR. And all of a sudden, people were like, oh, like,
So this is just cute, like cute to real. Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, all of a sudden for me, I kind of started crafting out my identity in economics, like kind of simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, y'all racist and what you're doing is this. It was resonating. And I was like, whoa, okay. Then like, if it's resonating, then I feel like at the end of the day, like, I can kind of keep going with this. I can make equity sort of central to the work that I'm doing mm-hmm. here in economics and see how far we can take it. And so the Sadie Collective really kind of grew out of my co-founder and I, the founding team's sort of deep passion in ensuring that our friends, their friends had access to resources and networks. And now we have like close to, I think it's more than 1,000 Black women across the country, folks who are across, you know, different global regions, a number of different allies, as well as institutions that are affiliated. Mm-hmm. We've gotten to the point now where people want the Sadie Collective approval because they want to have more Black people in their organization. And so like, for me, it's been like kind of a whirlwind. It's really sort of changed the trajectory of my life.
Yeah. So how it does the organization address the issue and what opportunities does it provide?
Yeah. So it's a couple of different things, right? So obviously through programming, our conferences are sort of the flagship aspect of the organization.
So networking, I mean, yeah, it's, networking. Yeah, perfect opportunity, right?
Networking in the sense of like you're meeting different organizations and institutions and stakeholders in the mm-hmm. space, but then I would say community building more so yeah. because you are meeting other only one Black mm-hmm. women
yeah.
who are across the space as well. And what we find is that people might be in the same area, but they're unaware
yeah.
that the like another Black woman is in the area, etc. And so the conferences are really kind of a you have to be there type of thing, right? Because it's very, I want to say cathartic, but is that the word? I don't know.
Well, I can imagine what it would be. I mean, I would think that being able to speak freely, the freedom of, and you know, the word safe space gets a bad rap these days because everybody's like, space. No, but it is. It's a place where you don't feel hampered by those things that in your normal day-to-day life, you have to tiptoe around.
You can literally just be. The space is catered to you.
Right.
And so that's essentially what we were aiming to do. And even virtually, we were able to successfully do it.
Talk about that a little
bit.
So that's amazing. Like everybody else is like, yeah, but y'all like, we're virtual.
Right. So, you know, shout out to my co-founder, Fanta, for really kind of heading that. The virtual conference was great. I think we had over like 500 registrants. A number of different organizations came through, probably our highest yet. Mm-hmm. And people just felt like, yes, I'm not seeing these people physically, but I'm still in this sort of space
right.
of other Black women who are just as passionate about these issues as I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned also the Latinx.
Yeah.
And so is the Sadie Collective also for just women of color? Is it, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
does it
absolutely.
Broaden out to being inclusive yeah. in that manner?
That's a really great question. So the Sadie Collective specifically is for Black women, but there's programming that is more so for underrepresented minority groups. Mm-hmm. So an example of this is that we partnered with the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank when I was CEO last year. And basically the program was to expose Black college students, regardless of gender, to just sort of economic skills, et cetera. So people like learned R, which is like a programming mm-hmm. Thing, as well as got to know other economists. But that was also like more broadly, like if you were underrepresented minority, you could just like come in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's some aspect of the conference too that allows folks who are underrepresented minorities to just kind of come in that are women, that identify as women, or, you know, identify as both genders, right?
Right.
So I think for the whole thing, ultimately, we're advocating for a larger marginalized group, but Black women, as you know, don't get the respect and the attention that they deserve. And so we want to be really specific about mm-hmm. the kind of programming we're putting out just for them.
I think one of the things you said a little bit earlier was this idea of the Black women being sort of the economic powerhouse within their own, again, having trouble with English today, but their own area, you know, the regions
yeah.
where they, you know, and they're the ones who are picking up that slack.
Yeah. And I think people think, you know, when you say, Black women are sort of the backbone of communities, people kind of say it like, it's just, that's just like a nice idea. No, that's like evidence, it's right? Yeah. Right. So like there's like, I think close to 80% of Black mothers are the primary breadwinners in their house, right? Which means that if they're not getting jobs, if they're getting laid off, like we're seeing with the pandemic, then all of a sudden entire communities are affected by the fact that these women are not able to get to work.
Right.
So it's not necessarily about, oh, we're trying to do something nice for Black women. It's understanding that our very economy, our very country relies on Black women, and I would say more broadly, Black and brown women, including Latinx folks.
Right, yeah. So in 2020, I didn't know this, you were the youngest recipient of the CEDAW Women's Right Award by the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, previously awarded to our now U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and U.S. Majority House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Tell us about this award. What is it about? What is this purpose? And are you making, you're like,
listen.
And how did you feel when you, like, they were like, hey, you got this?
I was confused because, you know, I didn't know someone had nominated me for it. I actually don't know how that process goes. I think they might just be like looking across and then they select. And it seemed like it was more local to San Francisco, which is where this chapter is based. So that's why, you know, we see Vice President Kamala Harris as one of the recipients.
Right, because she, yeah.
But this was actually around the time that Breonna Taylor's situation happened. So I dedicated my award to Breonna Taylor, right? Like, when we're talking about social justice, I mean, accolades are cute, but, like, that's not what moves the needle, right? We have to actually be out there doing what needs to be done so that people feel empowered enough to change the spaces around them. And so I'm happy that they acknowledge, like, oh, Anna's doing something. But I think for me, it was more like, thank you so much, but also let's get to work, right? Like, there's things that we got to do.
Yeah. No.
But I was very humbled, though. I mean, it's quite a flex.
Quite the flex, right? So, all right, you know, what's next? You're wearing the shirt, right? Harvard Kennedy School. Working on a book, which I know because I've gotten to read it. I was so excited. What's next? And talk a little bit about the book.
Yeah. So, what's next? Wow. That's a great question. So, I secretly applied to graduate school, unbeknownst to a lot of people. If I had said something, folks would have been like, can you apply here? No. So I thankfully got into Harvard Kennedy School, which is kind of crazy, but really exciting. I think it's an excellent fit for the kind of work that I'm interested in doing. So I'm going to be doing a PhD in public policy at Harvard Kennedy School. And then in addition to that, as you've mentioned, I'm working on a book, but I'm also working on another book. So one of the books is coming before the book that you read. So the first book is called The Black Agenda, Bold Solutions for a Broken System. It's going to be an essay collection that features a number of Black experts that are going to be weighing in on a number of policy issues. No book has existed like this before, which I think is kind of insane.
And I'm getting a copy from my library one?
Absolutely. Okay. Just saying, put your name in it. I was like, yeah, of course, right? And the book really was inspired from the fact that around the time the pandemic started, there was a lot of talk about racial disparities in the economy and health and education, et cetera, but no Black people were being asked to talk. No Black people were being cited. I actually did a snap analysis in the New York Times op-ed section in their frequent column, The Upshot, and I was just looking at economists. They had cited about 42 economists in the month of March. None of them were Black. None of the articles were about race. And I was like, this doesn't make sense, because we know that, like, Black and brown folks are disproportionately being affected by these issues.
Because there's numbers.
That's exactly right. Like, people are actually doing it. I know this. People are doing the analysis because I followed them on Twitter. Why aren't you talking to these people? And sometimes people would come and be like, oh, and how do you feel? And I'm like, have you reached out to the economist that, like, does this? You know? So I think for me, it was kind of like, how do I best honor the Black experts that have been clearly putting in the work and no one has really been paying attention to them? And that's kind of when I pitched to my literary agent, like, hey, I have an idea. I think it should be leaning more towards Black women in terms of the kind of experts that we're picking up. But this is something that I think would be really good. And so as a result, the Black Agenda, Bold Solutions for a Broken System came to be. It's coming out first day of Black History Month next year.
Nice.
The blurbs come from Wes Moore, which is a very full circle moment for
me. Thank you.
because The Other Westmore was a book that we had to read here at Glendale.
Yes, it was a summer. I was one of the ones who was like, we need to read this book.
I appreciate you because for me, it was a book that helped me understand my racial identity within America and how that sort of intersects with opportunity and access. And talking with Westmore about
such
it,
a, so like, you got to talk to him.
Yeah, God, he's cool. He's a nice guy.
It was such really cool. It was an incredible book. And I actually, totally off topic.
No.
My niece, who is graduating high school, and she was in AP Lit. And she was like, Auntie Nikki, she's like, Nikki, I have this book list of books, and I'm supposed to pick one. And I have no idea what to pick. And I don't want to do Catcher in the Rye. I said, no, you don't. and I was like, you need to read this one. I handed her The Other Westmore. You've got to read this. She came back. She was like, that was so good. I was like, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think that making people aware, particularly because the it's local, it's happening right under our noses.
Yeah.
And so for me, that local connection was really important to bring into the space.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so Chelsea Clinton is the other blurb, which is really cool. So she got to preview the book.
I'm squeeing right
now.
Yeah,
it's really cool. So a lot of people are really excited about the book. I'm really excited about the book. I'm a little nervous because obviously it's going to land well with most folks, but like some people are going to be like...
But you know what?
Black
everybody,
people.
Everybody. I say that every day.
Who cares? No, yeah. So that being said, I'm excited about that. And then obviously the children's book is the one that you've seen. So I'm writing a children's book. It's probably one of the hardest writing projects I've ever done. Writing for kids.
It's hard writing for kids, isn't it?
It's difficult.
It's, you know,
Yeah, but it's been really rewarding. It's finally like copy edited. And so now
Oh, good. So I get to see the most recent.
So we have a black woman illustrator who is going to be sort of interpreting the words. It's going to be focused on the first black economist, Dr. Sadie Alexander. Many people know her as the first president of the Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated. She also was the first black woman to graduate from the University of Penn Law School. So I thought, you know.
I mean, can you, like, that is so...
And this was it, like, this was like pre-civil rights.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you just look at that and you're like, oh, the woman, the gumption of that woman.
The gumption. That's exactly right. And the audacity, which I think is really awesome. So, yeah, these are two books that I'm working on. And then there's a couple projects that I'm doing as well. And I usually just write articles and stuff. I'm also on Twitter, which has become sort of like an outlet, but a way that I can communicate with other people about these issues that I'm really passionate about.
Yeah. So... You're how old now? Like you've done all this, like...
So I'm 24.
24.
I'm going on 25.
25.
I guess 20, like I said, no, 13 days.
30 days. So our party is when? Oh. So where do you think all of this is headed? What do you want at you? Because you're going to grad school, you're going to get all that done. And then what? Where do you, I mean, President of the United States?
It's so funny. You're the seventh person to say that.
Well, just because
I don't want that job.
You know, I mean, really.
It's so hard. and also it ages you quickly.
Yeah.
I would say like, I do see myself back in DC, running stuff. So one thing I learned was recently, there's not more than like 10 or 12 black women in DC right now who are doing anything related to economic policy.
Okay.
Which, that's out of thousands.
I was gonna say that's
of economists, right? Like even the Federal Reserve in DC by itself hires about 400 people. Not a single person is a black woman, right? So I think for me, I'm looking at DC like, I mean, one, the DMV is a great place to live if you're black. I feel like this is an awesome area to live in. But also, I think from more of like a what my passion is, it's really kind of being in the middle of the action and making sure that things actually get done, right? So it's one thing to like obviously be a professor, you know, contribute to the literature and have people cite your work and use that as a way to like justify their policies, et cetera. It's another thing to actually like be in DC advocating for those policies in addition to doing the research alongside that. So I think for me, that's kind of where I see myself career-wise. And then I would say like sky's the limit. I think at the age of 24, I haven't peaked yet, right? So it's funny. I had a conversation with one of the producers of Marketplace last year. They had invited me on the show, and I actually didn't realize it was that Marketplace when I It's kind of an insane story. So they were like, oh, it's this marketplace. And I was like, okay, like, I don't know what that is. I was like, I don't understand this logo, but I guess I'll talk to you guys. And then my mentor in Michigan was like, hey, I heard you on Marketplace this morning. And I was like, how? Like, what do you mean? I was like, Marketplace on NPR?
NPR Marketplace.
No, like, that's insane, right? So that being said, the producer kind of followed me up and was like, you know, Anna, I just want to say, like, we're going to be talking about you for the next 40 years. And I was like, ah, like, what do you mean? And she's like, I really think, like, the way you're headed, I don't even think you understand, like, what's coming. And I said, I truthfully don't. But I think for me, I'm looking at it as, how can I make the situation better for people now and for people later, right? Mm-hmm. I've always been focused on how do we ensure that the future generations have a much better time in this world, in this country, than I did. So, you know, part of that is really what drives the work that I do. Like, having a book of Black experts is really so people in the future can kind of refer to them as a way to think about policymaking and issues that ultimately will benefit everybody in this country. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what would your advice be for those young women that,
yeah,
you know, walk through these hallways, you know, in their skirts, you know,
not you throwing shade.
What would your advice be? Because we, you know, one of the things about GCS, a lot of people talk about, we are, and you talk about the private schools in this area.
Yeah.
We are one of, if not the most diverse populations. What advice do you have for these young women that I look at every day as they walk through this hallway?
Yeah. Well, do you mind if I also give advice to like the
100% administrators? Absolutely.
Okay, great. Excellent. Please. I love. Yeah. You feel me? Yeah. So I would say first and foremost, like for the young folks, like, you know, it's never too early to really like make a change. If you feel really passionate about something, just do it. I always say ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
Not for permission.
Right?
Nice.
I mean, that's kind of how I moved in this place.
Yeah,
sure.
Same.
I was like, I'm going to study racism in private schools. You're going to tell me no? I already did it. Like, you know, you're not. And I think that was kind of how I moved, right? And I think at the end of the day, you never know who you're going to impact if you move like that. Obviously, you have to move with good faith. And then I would also say just, like, be authentic. I think a lot of times people get really caught up in the clout. You know, do anything for clout? Don't. Well, why are you doing that, right? At the end of the day, I feel like the clout is something that comes along with you honoring your best self. And that means that you have to put forth your best foot. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? Like, you have to be somebody who really embraces what life is giving you, but also you're open to learning what life can teach you. And I think for me, that like that really begins with humility. That begins with being somebody who is, get to know your teachers. Quite frankly, they're really cool, right? Like, for me, I spent a lot of times talking to Ms. Astro, talking to Shematek, talking to Mr. Hudgens. I was in that room a lot, right?
Mm, yeah.
Just talking. And I think, to some extent, you have to understand that there are people who know a lot more than you, and maybe you disagree with them on a number of different things, but hearing their perspective can really help round out your own perspective and help you craft out your own voice. And I think, for me, being very forthright about doing that early on has really been pivotal for sort of where I'm at now at the age that I'm at. And then I would say, you know, if you see something that's off, call it out. I think that's something that a lot of us, you know, are a little bit hesitant to do, right? I know when I was at GCS, things would come on my radar, but they wouldn't come to me, right? So I would hear maybe something is a little off, and my friend would be like, hey, this thing happened. I said, I ain't hear it. Right? And I think at the end of the day, it was people kind of knew what my standards were and they didn't want to cross that. Right? Mm-hmm. So I think being really clear about who you are and how you show up in the space is going to be something that will take you far, especially in college where there's going to be a lot of things thrown at you. You need that sort of grounding mm-hmm. to move through that kind of space. I would say for administrators, where do I start? You know, equity is not a one-time project. Right. You can't get a diversity inclusion director and say you're done. Like, that's just not going to be sufficient. Inclusion is really about ensuring that the Black and brown folks in your space feel like they can just be in your space. They don't have to be sort of seeing how their identity is kind of, you know, clashing against whatever policies that are in sort of the specific space that they're occupying. And so, you know, equity is more than hiring a diversity person, which, you know, the tea is that GCS was like one of the last independent schools to do that. That's a problem, right? So I think understanding that it's not about just having Black and brown faces in the room, but ensuring that those Black and brown faces feel like their identities are not taking away from their experience while they're in the room.
And that, they don't have to do that shuffle.
That's exactly
that,
right.
That identity shuffle. That double consciousness. Who am I talking to? That's what exactly am I saying? Right. How am I being heard?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that means that, you know, like if you see something that's off, right, you see something that clearly that's like racist or sexist or one of the phobias, right, then you really need to be intentional about calling that out, but calling that out through a systemic manner. Like, it's not enough to just say like, that's a bad thing, don't do that no more, but maybe even adding consequences to that to ensure that the space itself is setting the standards of, you know, what conduct looks like and what does it look like to be in an inclusive and equitable space that people are honored and feel welcomed in. And so that's the kind of work that, you know, I'm doing. I'm kind of gunning for these institutions right now.
What?
Right? Because a lot of these institutions don't want to, like, be real with themselves. They'll say, oh, I want Black people, but, you know, not those kind of Black people. Or I'm not going to HBCUs, though. Oh. Like, they don't really educate Black people. But the thing is, like, what do you mean, right? Like, you just want, I mean, I speak plainly. You just want Black and brown people who are as close to white people as possible. And that's, you're just not going to get that, yeah. Right?
Here, Felicia Rasad is going to Howard.
That's exactly right.
I'm so excited. Sorry. I saw that today and I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think HBCUs in particular get a bad rap. Excuse me. And so I would say shout out to the Black students who are here at Glen Elg. You know, don't write off of HBCU. Don't write off a minority.
Nikki Awatunde is in med school at Howard.
Right. That's exactly right. A majority minority institution. You'd be surprised how important it is for you to understand how your identity fits within that bigger group of people who look just like you. So I think for me, going from a school like this, GCS, which was predominantly white, to a school like UMBC, which is majority minority, and then being integrated into the Myerhoff Scholars Program, the Mark Scholars Program, which literally cultivates the top Black STEM talent across the country, was a game changer. It helped me like really understand who am I as a Black person, but more broadly, who am I as a person, and how does that fit into these sort of institutions that have been here for centuries on end?
Yeah. I love that you earlier, before we started this, you were talking to Mr. Hudgens, and you talked about how he helped you learn to be direct.
Yeah.
And I love that because I think that
to
that's
my parents' detriment.
Your parents, what are they teaching
They're
you?
Like, why are you so honest? And yeah. I'm like.
But I think that that's something that people they shy away from.
Oh, yeah. People don't like confrontation. That's what I've learned in my short life, is that people really don't want to be honest with themselves, and therefore they can't be honest with you. And I think for me, I had to, like, do a lot of self-reflection and say, like, okay, like, let me be honest with myself and really take time to do that. Like, that's, like, an ongoing thing. And I think for me, that's enabled me to be as honest as possible with others. And I think in the policy space especially, people like to, you know, like, tiptoe around things and not really say things, like, head on. Like, that person's being racist. Why are we talking about, like, oh, they're feeling like this? Like, I'm not sure if they're really, like, you know, happy about Black people. It's like, no, like, they're just racist. Like, use the correct terminology, right? And I think, you know, studying under Mr. Hudgens, studying under you, you know, formerly Ms. Greenberg, right? You know, the humanities courses in this school especially really sort of helped me kind of craft my voice and be as direct as possible with what I'm saying. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want you to miss what I'm putting out, right? You know, don't read between
be
the
clear.
Lines. That's exactly right. And so I think for me, like, speaking about Mr. Hudgens in particular, there were times when we were asked to, like, literally debate issues that maybe you didn't agree with the take, but you had to be as clear as possible about the take so the rest of the people in your classroom could either agree or disagree, et cetera. And I think for me, that was just a really, really helpful exercise because that's, like, literally what I do on Twitter all mm-hmm. day, every day, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, being able to be very clear about, like, no, like, this is how I'm feeling about this, and here's the evidence.
Here's the evidence. That's really,
been kind of, like, my mantra and how I move through the world now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So, anything else that you want the world at large to know about, you know?
Yeah, I would say, you know, this space is a space that quite literally taught me economic inequality before I knew that what it was. You know, I actually tweeted about this today. I was not about this school in particular, but I was kind of alluding to my educational experience, kind of going from a school like this, which is, as I mentioned to you all both, like, people rent out Raven stadiums, you know, like, for their bar mitzvahs. Like, that's insane, right? Or people would be rocking, like, Gucci or Coach, mm-hmm. like regularly. Going from this environment to my low-income neighborhood where it's, like, subsidized housing, et cetera, mm-hmm. I mean, it was stark. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And I think if any other students are going through a similar experience, know that, like, you're absolutely justified in saying, like, this doesn't make sense. Like, this isn't correct, right? Like, right. The fact that resources are concentrated in one area versus another area. And so if that's something that really inspires you to actually make a difference, then I would move on that. Move on that feeling. Move on that sort of prompting. Because ultimately, it's an all-hands-on-deck situation, right? We're talking about systems that existed for hundreds of years.
Right.
Being right now, a lot of them are starting to crumble before right. our eyes.
But you're still shifting the Titanic.
And that's exactly, it's a big boat. And mm-hmm. we're just now turning the wheel.
Yeah.
It's going to take everybody in that sense. And so if you feel really convicted to do that kind of work in college right now, even later on in your life, like, I would really move on that. And I would say it's thankless work. It's work that's not cute. It's not going to get you all the friends that you want, right? Some rich people might be mad at you. You know what I'm saying? People of different races might be mad at you. But I think it's work that, you know, ultimately honors humanity. And I think that's really where you should be shooting for. Like, make sure that your work is honoring humanity, is really ensuring that people are living better lives than they've lived, you know, prior to you arriving mm-hmm. there. And having that be what ultimately leads you into, you know, the greatness that you have within you. And so I feel like for me, that's kind of how I've moved. And, you know, what I'll say to end sort of is your support system, who is in your community, really matters. I come back here mainly because my educators, and I consider, you know, the varsity basketball team, also the coaches, as my educators, right? Like, were just really pivotal to my experience growing up. Like, I knew, I was hyper aware that I was the only Black student at my elementary school. I was, you know, hyper aware that one of the few Black, like, I'm not, like, you know, biracial or anything. Like, I can't pass as white, right? Like, I'm clearly dark skinned, right? And I'm, you know, I'm not mad about that at all, but it's just sort of like being hyper aware of that. My educators never really made me feel othered. And I think that was critical to everything that you're seeing now. It set a foundation of how I view mentorship, how I view allyship, how I communicate, how I see the world. And that's why I say it's really important for people to understand just the role educators play in shaping the next generation. And which is why I get really mad when teachers don't get paid enough, right? Teacher Appreciation Week, no, pay teachers more, right? Like, I don't, that's the best way to appreciate, make sure there's policies that protect folks who are really essentially taking care of the next generation and ensuring that those individuals get their flowers and a lot more. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for the shout out there.
Of course.
All right. So, appreciate that. I'm going to...
Wow. See, we're done. That was a good conversation.
Wait, I'm going to be super mad at this thing. Oh, no. Okay.